listening to New Layer, a design podcast with Tanner Christensen and Jasmine Friedel.
When it comes to digital product design, there are three core areas of expertise that designers need to have.
Yes. Or at least that's how we break them down.
Yeah, right. Product thinking, interaction design, visual design.
Yes, sir.
Those are the key three things as we define digital product design today.
Mm-hmm.
Today, I want to talk with you about that second kind of step,
interaction design. Yep.
What does interaction design mean? Why does it matter? How can designers get efficient at it? All of this kind of fun things.
Even the what is it is interesting. Because sometimes it's easy for me to just say, oh, that's the UX part of the UX UI split. But it's not quite that cut and dry because UX designers often do product thinking. And sometimes we have interaction designers who are the UX and UI designers. Like I think IDEO calls their interaction designers. They're just their product designers. So, yeah.
That makes sense to me. Like I'm thinking through this now and I could see UX designers, which, you know, is user experience designers. Their skill set is, I think, visual primarily, but a core component of that visual design. To make a visual design effective, you need to consider the interaction flows of that design.
Right. One mistake I made early on in my career, or as I was learning, it was mostly when I was sort of like transitioning from graphic design to product design. I thought interaction design was like animation design.
Oh my gosh. I was going to say the same thing. I remember when you and I first started talking about product design many years ago, I was so confused between the difference of interaction design and interactions design.
Yeah. And we call that, those are like micro interactions.
Right. To give an example.
Do you have a good one?
I mean, how a modal pops up.
Yeah, like
what happens when you tap on a button, the animation that occurs there to indicate you have tapped on a button.
Yeah. And so like for a button, it might be the press state, which like might darken a little bit. For a modal, it might be the, you know, where it comes from. I guess a modal wouldn't probably slide down from the top of a page. It'll usually sort of like pop up from the center. How that drop shadow might grow beneath it. What happens when you close it, how it collapses. Could be even things like how the page scrolls or any sort of, you know.
Yeah, like on most devices, when you're scrolling a list and it's got a little bit of inertia to it, and when you reach the bottom or the top of the list, it kind of bounces just slightly. So all of the things we're talking about now are what I interpret as, I think that's actually visual design, or it's an element of visual design.
Yeah, and when we look at it, it's a piece of polish.
Right. So interaction design is not those things. What is interaction design?
Yeah, I'm wondering why I don't have a super concrete definition tucked away for this. I think when we usually talk about it, we usually say things like, you know, this is when we talk about flows. This is when we talk about user journeys. This is when we talk about how people get from point A to point B, if it's a task-based experience, or how they explore if it's an engagement-based experience. This is the system of pages. This is the architecture. And so I think those are the kinds of things I look at. These are the considerations of the entire system, not just what we call the happy paths, which are A to B when something goes perfectly and smoothly.
Oh, you're teasing out what we're
gonna be
talking
here. Yeah. So interaction is really about, I like to think about it as, you know, really if we do interaction well, it gets to good usability.
Exactly. Interaction design really is the overarching flows a user or customer will take across the product experience to achieve a goal. And part of interaction design comes down to the discoverability of interactions that you can take and the successful or not successful states of those interactions.
And I guess I look at that as the surface of it, the paths that a user will take, finding those paths, going through those paths, completing those paths. But when I look at it on the back end, I look at it from more of a systems perspective.
Right. The architecture of literally how this app or experience will be built.
Right. And it's another mistake I made was like, it's not just a site map, like documenting everything that does exist. It's documenting things like how people move between them. And here's where you'll see a lot of like this is one of, I talk a bit about some of the lost arts in product design, and which formerly came from mostly more traditional UX designers, but a lot of the diagramming that UX designers used to do, like Jesse James Garrett, I've mentioned him before, you'd see these diagrams with like diamonds and rectangles, and rectangles might be pages or spaces, and the triangles were decision-making points. Diamonds are decision-making points, and triangles mean, I forget what they mean, but there's this language, to diagram out these systems of experiences that aren't necessarily even linked page to page. It's, sort of a language of journeys that people take through a system.
Right. Because in a lot of these maps, what you'll often have are states or decisions, like you mentioned, that are usually diamond shaped, that are not going to be necessarily reflected in the product itself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the value, I think, to many of these kind of outputs of interaction design, this kind of mode of thinking of flows and journeys across the product experience, is because if you're designing a product, and let's say you're responsible for a screen in the product, mm-hmm. maybe like a list of groceries or a user settings page or something like that, you can't really design that single screen effectively if you're not considering everything that comes before that screen and after that screen. How will people get into that page? What is their mental model? How do they understand where they just came from and where they can go next? And then on top of that, what happens if they do something wrong in that screen, and how does the app experience help them understand what they can do next and where it's going to help them go in order to accomplish or achieve the objective that the experience has been designed for at a more holistic level.
And if you're looking for, I was just looking up what the site is called, but from Jesse James Garrett, it's called A Visual Vocabulary for Describing Information Architecture in Interaction Design. And we can post this, but it's well worth looking up. Tanner, you and I have taught a class on an intro to product design, and we go through them in sections: product thinking, interaction design, and visual design. We do it in a highly simplified way, just to make sure that within 6 weeks our students can get the just the high level understanding of what a full end to end product design experience is. And when we get to interaction design, when we're going through the work of understanding what needs to happen, what we do is we start from user journeys. We start from, hey, what are the main things that need to happen to solve the problem? And we start to sketch them out inside and outside of a digital experience. And some examples, you know, we've done to-do apps, we've done video chats. Some examples, like for a to-do app, is you might like have this idea that you have to do something, and then you open your app and how do you write it down? And we start to think through, like, hey, what are the key things that someone must do to document all the way through completing your to-do item? And so it's things like enter in text. You know, they must have a checkbox. They must be able to submit that. They must be able to mark it completed. And so some of the key things that we've pulled out from that are understanding how to understand what key moments are, and then translate that into experiences. And then we take people through, okay, well, if you understand that this is a key moment in the digital experience, are there actions that have to be taken there? And then we start to document those, and those translate into things like the decision-making points in the information architecture, or these diagrams that we're talking about. Is there content that needs to be there? That might be something that is actually done in the interaction design phase, but really completed in the visual design phase. And so what are the things that need to happen in these key moments? And that's the first step, is to really making sure you can get from A to B, and then the considerations of what happens when something goes wrong happens usually later.
A common mistake that I think we see come up when people think about interaction design and some of these outputs or these exercises is they will either do one of two things, the designer will, or the team will. One is they'll rely on personal opinion, saying,
"Ooh,
oh, I know how to use a to-do app. I'm going to just do what I know. I'm going to go into an app. I'm going to enter my item. I've got the list. I can mark it as done or not." There's a lot of limits to that. The other thing is they either talk to like one person, sometimes like a friend or a family member or a coworker, to try to think about the interaction flows and what is the journey that our users may take. And neither of those things are really comprehensive enough to create a really strong interaction pattern. Instead, what I think needs to be done is a few things. And we talk about this in our class that we teach as well. Audit existing products. Go see what their flows look like from end to end. Like really think about the task you're trying to accomplish and how these product experiences achieve them. Not in terms of, again, visuals. Like we don't care about where the button is placed, but we care about what can I do at any given point and what happens once I like take that step.
Yeah, what action can be taken.
The other is just talk to a lot of people that you're intending to design for. We talk a lot about research and customer conversations and all these kind of things. But the reality is you can develop a really keen insight into what the user journeys will be for you by just talking to as many people as you can about what they expect to do. And even in the absence of like a digital product, what does their workflow look like for accomplishing a similar task today in the absence of that software?
I think it will be helpful for us to pause and put this in the context of product design. Because I think we're assuming a little bit of familiarity with what this is and what tasks are. So I would say right now, the product thinking phase, which I don't know if we've talked about this or not, but that usually comes first. And that is all about defining the problem to be solved, evaluating whether it's a problem or not, understand who is affected by it, understanding what the goals are when we solve this problem, business goals or user goals, usually a bit of both. Things like that. And so when we're talking about user journeys, we're actually coming into this phase of interaction design with a really solid problem and saying, now that we know and have proved that there is a problem or an opportunity, it doesn't always have to be a problem. Sometimes it can be something that doesn't exist that we want to fill a gap for or move an industry ahead in. But we're coming with this strong, solid understanding. And now we're saying, how then does technology solve the problem? And so then we're getting into we believe that, you know, if we create a number of digital experiences or a digital experience, we can solve that problem. And so what we're trying to do here is we're trying to make sure that we understand what someone would need to do to solve that problem. And that's where that sort of tie between inside and outside of technology is a really great tool to use. And this is usually what we think of as service design when we think of sort of, you know, someone is moving between digital and human experiences, and the technology enters in as a service to help get someone through that. And often when we think about service design, we actually think about industries that are doing both human, like banking is a great example, that are doing both human service as well as digital service. But there's some element of a stage where in front of the curtain where the service acts are being performed, and then there's the behind the curtain, and then there's the far behind the scenes look at it. And there's different levels of what's happening to bring the service to the forefront. I don't know if I explained that well. Look up service design if you're interested. But really bringing that sort of like, what's the problem, and then what's our role in solving it, and how might we do that? That's really what interaction design is all about.
Yep. Something you mentioned earlier on this episode was the architecture of the experience. And this is something that many designers, I don't think, are very privy to. They don't really expose themselves to this. They may talk with engineers as it relates to, I'm designing this thing, how would you build this thing? But there's a lot of value in sitting down with the engineering team, the product team, if you have them, researchers, really the whole gamut of cross-functional peers, in order to understand how what you're designing will come to fruition in a large interaction kind of systems kind of way. Even if you don't understand the technical nuances of how something's going to get built, it's important to know what's possible, what's not, what's conventional, what's not, and how users will really navigate this experience. And I think that's something designers tend to avoid, but it's really valuable. You don't need to learn how to code, that common debate, but you do need to know how your engineers are thinking about connecting these different pieces of the experience together so that you can kind of reflect that in the design as well and influence that.
Yeah. And this makes me think of one of my favorite topics or skills within design, which is generation and evaluation, like just going really broad and finding a lot of solutions and evaluating them, which isn't just for visual design. Like we think of that a lot of times when you think of brand, like somebody who's wanting a new logo or a new identity, like the the graphic designer that's going to do that is going to come up with 1,000, probably present 5, and then maybe narrow it down to 3 and then come to a final. We should be doing that too in interaction design and in visual design, but in interaction design. And when we're talking about like, you know, journey maps, we may be saying like, hey, what's the aspirational way or what's the best way to get this done or the desired way to get it done? We might also be documenting how are people doing this now, whether it's digital or non-digital. And then we also might be saying, hey, what exactly what you're talking about, what are the constraints? What are the things that we can do? And that's talking to engineers, talking to product managers. And a lot of times that's one of the most important steps because, you know, you as a designer might, you know, do a full design on the interaction design wireframes or whatever that is and present your final, like, let's do it this way. And then an engineering manager comes to you and says, that's actually, you know, not technically feasible. And so understanding what's possible, and that doesn't mean it's limiting. It means you may just have to have early discussions with engineering teams on like, hey, where can we budge? Where can we improve? And often, you know, you'll come and get something like, oh, we need to rewrite the entire code base in order to enable this thing that you want to do. And then, and you may need to talk about like, well, this is really valuable and this will change the way people see our product. And so, you know, how much investment is that? Well, it's 6 months. Okay. You know, maybe we need to see if there's a compromise, but those discussions really are helpful to be had up front to document them and understand, what the constraints are as long. And then also I think there's an opportunity to ask those people who know the constraints, how are you thinking of the solution to this?
Yeah, definitely. In order to have those conversations, it can be really, really helpful to bring some tangible artifacts or documentation to those conversations. And I think that's where we come to these like journey maps, these process flows, service flows. These are the kind of things that can be really helpful for engaging in these conversations or even making sense of all these ideas that you might have in your head around how things connect. So I'm curious for you, Jasmine, have you worked on a product where your team or someone on the team has a like very comprehensive map of the product experience? Have you ever seen anything like that?
I mean, I've done them before.
Yeah.
Do you want me to talk about it?
Please.
When I was working on the Summit Learning platform at Facebook and CZI, I did a documentation of how our whole system worked.
What did that look like? What shape did that take?
It was basically a conceptual mapping. It was a system mapping that allowed us to talk Okay. So when we talk about system models and system models are how they work. Conceptual models are how we explain them to people, and mental models are how people interpret them. And we had actually created our conceptual model, how we explain them, in the same way that we had designed our system model. And basically, I'm going to see if I remember this correctly. For students, we were looking at, I might oversimplify here, but basically a course contains maybe lessons that contain focus areas or something like that. It was basically a cascading. And I guess if you think of school, you've got a class that you take, and then within that class, you're going to go through sections of content. And within that sections, there's going to be like mini lessons or something like that, or lessons. And so there's these three cascading steps. And so I documented this because we were creating learning materials for teachers, and we were looking at the problem that we needed to be solved was we needed to create from scratch learning content from teachers that they could learn in the same way that kids learn. And we were looking at different philosophies of how kids learn versus how students learn. And there was a benefit in having teachers learn in the same way their students were going to learn in order to be able to learn the model themselves and to have experienced it themselves. But we also know that teachers aren't students. You know, somebody who's 14 is not the same as a tenured, you know, 50-year-old teacher or somebody who's 24 and teaching. Like, we just know that they are able to be disciplined and focused in a way that sometimes kids aren't. And so the problem I was solving was, how do we translate a student experience and meet both those needs, help them learn the model, but also get the content to them in a more efficient way. And so the way I looked at that was taking the system model, which was this cascading system, which was also how we described it, and translate that in a much simplified way. And so I ended up using the information architecture language. I ended up doing that and then proposing some changes in a similar information architecture model that was simplified. And that, even before I got into screens, that gave me an opportunity to make a few proposals like, hey, we can do it exactly the same. We can duplicate this platform and build it the same way for teachers, or we can build it in the simplified way and talk through it, meeting those goals. And I think that's a really interesting way to speed interaction design up, where I wasn't getting into screens and saying, oh, I think the hierarchy of it should be this way. I think, you know, we can, or getting into visual design and saying like, oh, we can actually just make the typeface smaller. They'll be able to read it faster. We don't have to have all these, you know, tips and tricks or whatever it is. I actually just got to the core of the problem and said, what's the model we want to look after? Once we decided that, then I flipped over. I just basically copied the visual design and some of the interaction designs that we had, like how you get from page to page. And then I optimized it for teachers. It was really a short project. And I think in some ways then I was like, why is this so easy? And it's because I did the interaction design work up front.
Yeah, I love that. It's a really great example. The opposite of what you just described is something that I'm going through now. So, you know, I work in a startup where velocity is one of our key company values. We're constantly trying to ship very quickly and get things out the door. And I've been at the company for almost a year now, and we don't really have any of these interaction flows mapped out yet very well. Mm-hmm. In fact, the design team is working on that right now. But in the absence of those things, we've been building out experiences. So parts of the product, certain feature areas, certain things to accomplish goals for our users. We've been building those out without real consideration for the larger experience.
Yeah. And that's really common for startups.
Yeah. It's effective. We're able to get things moving fast. We get customer feedback, we iterate, all those kind of things. But what we find is that we are actually moving a little bit slower than if we had invested in the experience design. What I mean by that is often I will give a design to an engineer. They'll start working on it. We'll all get agreement. This is the right way to go. We'll have conversations about the different ways to iterate on that design, and come ship time to get this thing out the door, the engineer and I will kind of look at each other and say, well, what about this use case? Like, what happens when they don't have data in the table? What's the null state? What happens when they try to delete this thing that doesn't exist? And like, all these issues start to arise. So investing in the interaction flow early is actually going to help circumvent some of these problems that you will inevitably run into down the road. So,
And some of that is a systems thing. Like, when do you invest in design systems? I remember another thing on the learning platform that I was working with where I was starting to get into tables. And so tables are a component that you develop. And we had tables that were used in one part of the platform, and the needs that I had for tables were in a different part of the platform. And I initially started off going like, we need to design a new table because this one isn't working. And then I had to talk to my engineers and say, actually, we need to retrofit the one that we have, or I need to retrofit my designs, because the frequency of use for that table was going to be really, really low, and it wasn't worth the investment of building a new table. And those are the kinds of things what you think when you're, I mean, we were a team of less than 50 all in. And so even though we were at bigger companies, we were very much so working like a startup. And those are things that you have to decide, is like, what's the cost? Another example I was thinking about is, even at bigger companies, I'll use a Dropbox example. Things like flows, like sharing, you can share from different points in Dropbox, and you should ask, like, should sharing be the same everywhere, or should I customize it for each individual case? And I mean, sharing should be the same everywhere. That's pretty simple things. And so what you're doing as a designer is you're actually thinking more in a systematic way. When I encounter something that already exists, am I opinionated about it? And I know you're amazing at this. When I encounter something new, am I already thinking about how might it scale? What might be the consequences of this if we built this or design this in a very bespoke way? And so those are things that when you think about your interaction design, you're always looking for, does this exist elsewhere, or what will happen if we need to use this again?
Now I want to talk about, I mean, I think you kind of answered this a little bit, but let's be more explicit. At what point either in a designer's career, and that's not the right, that's not the right frame. At what point of being part of a team and working on a product should designers consider interaction design?
At what point in a project?
Yeah, let's say like you just joined a team, you've been given a project.
Well, don't start there. It's after the product thinking piece. I mean, you've got, I feel like you have something you want to say.
I do. Okay. I'm wondering if there's a better way to move around it. But what I do personally, no matter what project I'm on, I always start, obviously, you know, with the product thinking, how does this relate to the business? How is this solving a real need? How do we have some evaluation that this is the right thing to be doing? And right away from there, I go to interaction design. Even if the product already exists, even if we're adding like a button to a screen or trying to flesh out something that's already built, I still want to think through the interaction flows and the implications of this new work that I'm doing on that existing journey or flow or experience. And the reason for that is pretty multifaceted. One reason I do that is just so I can really make sure that I'm doing my due diligence and I'm making sure that I understand the world that I'm building in. Because if I miss a piece, then I might be doing redundant work. I might be creating overhead for my engineers. I might be creating problems for the end users. Additionally, and another point is I'm actually helping the rest of my team understand the same things, because they have often the same mentality that I will go into the problem with, which is, okay, we're adding this thing to the screen. We're changing this feature. We're creating a new screen. And everyone's so focused on that one small part of the product that it can be really easy to overlook the overarching, encompassing ecosystem, the system.
Yeah. And I mean, I can bring in Intercom, not just because I love Intercom and I do, I miss them. But because we had such great process to understand where to bring this sort of thing in. So whenever we had, you know, we do our planning and we do our goals and we do our roadmaps. And when we had projects, we'd start with our project brief and we'd start with, when we'd share the project brief, either with the project brief or shortly after, we'd call what we called an intern concept. I know I've talked about this before, but it was either a suggested solution to the problem that we were bringing to the table with the project brief, or a variety of solutions we might be able to think through. But the whole idea was we'd align on a solution up front, so that the designer's job was coming up with that solution with product managers and engineers, but also so we just wouldn't spin out on solutions. And one of the requirements of that product solution, the interconcept, was we started to really think about requiring in that interconcept a documentation of the system model. And we talked about a lot of things. What I was really gunning for was to make sure that my folks had both a documentation and therefore understanding of an existing system model and a proposal of how to change it. And so that what that did was it helped us not just go straight to the like, oh, we can add this interaction or this thing to the experience. It was like, oh, actually, maybe if we just increased the speed and reliability of this, it would be better. Like, is there something on the back end or in the infrastructure that we needed to do? But it helped us not only identify the solutions, but also understand the implications of our solutions. And I think that's really, really key. And it's a time saver. It's one of the reasons that I look for people when I hire people who have systems thinking skills. And I've talked about this before. I think systems thinking is becoming a little bit of a lost, not systems thinking. I think it's becoming a bit of a lost skill.
Yeah. We talked about this in our podcast episode on systems thinking. If you haven't listened to it, I highly recommend you.
We just did that.
Yeah. Not too long ago. Yeah. So as you're saying this, one thing that comes to mind for me that many, many new designers may be feeling right now listening to this, if they're not overwhelmed by a lot of the lingo we're using. So maybe don't make
it. Yeah, it's kind of hard to talk. I knew when we get into this, I'm like, how are we going to talk about interaction design without actually showing things? We're just going to talk about it. So we'll have to give links and things like that.
Yeah, we'll have to get a little more specific. But one of the things that's coming to mind for me is this idea that as the product designer on a feature or area, or even if you're the sole designer on a team, you may feel like you need to be the sole owner or person responsible for understanding interaction design flows.
Say that once more.
So if I can see many designers listening to this and saying, yeah, this makes sense. I need to think holistically about the experience. I need to map it out. I need to have conversations, make sure that this makes sense and that it's a good process to help our users solve our problems. I need to be the one that is responsible for this. I own this. This is mine. I'm going to help the team understand the big picture, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's wrong.
Okay.
It's in some cases, it makes sense for design to own that. In fact, I think design should be a primary stakeholder in explaining and exploring interaction design flows. But I don't think design is ultimately the owner of it. I think that the team should be the owner of it. Engineers.
Well, particularly when you're thinking about systems, like we're literally talking about the systems of how we build things.
Right.
Yeah. And the tech stack and all of that.
Exactly.
But I think when we're talking about this, what I'm seeing it as is it doesn't matter who owns it, but it is the bridge between our technical partners and our
design
partners.
Between the functions.
Yeah.
Yeah. I totally agree. And so, we said this a minute ago, but I think it's worth repeating. One of the real immense values of exploring interaction design, mapping out these flows, understanding all the different components, understanding the underlying tech stack or architecture of what you're building, is it helps not only you, but it also helps the rest of your team, your company, really understand all the moving parts of what you're building and how they come together. And in the absence of that, you will often spend time burning out, pursuing the wrong thing, like the example you just gave.
Yeah. Have you ever presented something to a team and they go, well, have you thought of this other thing?
Right.
Has that ever happened to you?
Oh yeah.
And you're like, oh shoot, I didn't do my homework. And if you're already polishing that thing up and it's not the right thing, like, man, being sent back to the figurative drawing board or the actual drawing board, it's humbling.
Oh yeah. I feel like this is a tangential point now too, but I'll share it anyway. I remember once working on a team on a very notable part of a very global product, Facebook, where anytime a new designer joined the team, they would kind of go off and do some explorations on basically overhauling part of the product. And they'd always come back and be like, look at this great thing.
Happened all the time.
Yeah. And then we'd pull out like a literal drawer of printouts of the exact same design that had been done years before. You'd have to do some due diligence as a designer. But
go ahead. Excuse me as I choke. I think this goes back to like, you know, when you're working at a place that's been around for a while, you end up, even that hasn't, like you end up getting a lot of historical context. And it's often like, I know at Facebook for a while, we were terrible at documenting things. Like we'd do experiments and then they just fall by the wayside. And then, you know, 2 years later it'd come up and you'd have to go to that long timer or have that long timer say, we tried that a couple years back. It didn't work because of X, Y, and Z. And like, to say, oh, we should try it again because this is in different context. Like the actual activity of doing these things and documenting the systems and understanding how they work and why we didn't go with that decision, that just, it's not only a time saver, but it actually serves as a historical milestone or a historical marking point. I don't even know how you'd say that. But I think it actually ends up creating a more intentionally thought through history rather than, I designed this. Like if we would have done the system, we would have never gotten all the way to the, we tried this. And I think that's actually, it's not the fault of like, you came to the same conclusion a lot of other people did. It's that we actually didn't do the work to decide why we shouldn't even start that in the first place.
Yeah. In some cases you may uncover things that do change the circumstances, but usually that's not the case. So again, like having these artifacts, really digging into the interaction flows, the journeys, that can really, really, really help you and the team. In fact, one thing that I'm doing on my team right now, for all new designers who join my team, as part of their first week, I say, go create a map of the product as you understand it. And so they will go and they will literally create a visual map with decision trees and architecture and hierarchy on their own. And then as a team, we get together and compare all of the maps that we created from our first 2 weeks and see where there are differences and different perspectives of how we understand the flows and how the product comes together.
I think I've done that in a little bit of a different way where I've said, go work with your engineers and make a map.
Yeah.
Because you'll come up with a very different map there than you will of, or at least a much more in-depth. And I mean deep, like the system behind it. Rather than just like how I can click through the product. And I think both are valuable because, you know, the map of how I can use this is the same as how the user uses it.
Right.
And so that's like, you only get one chance to really have that experience as an inbound employee. And so I think what you're doing is really valuable. I think that the second thing to do is, you know, make sure you understand how it works. And I mean, I've done this before too. Sometimes when you come into a company, you're so excited and you just want to have impact and you're ready to work and you're ready to get a project, but you miss out on the opportunity to understand how it works and to build relationships with your cross-functional counterparts. And so like taking that time to make sure you have that depth of product understanding is really, 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 really valuable.
Yeah, this is a component of interaction design that I don't think we've talked about really, but it makes sense. It's so easy to look at something and be like, wow, this is trash, or this makes no sense. Why did the team build this
way? How many times have we said that about our own product?
Oh, all the time.
All the time.
I think it's natural. And to some degree, it can be healthy if it's not like a very...
But don't say that in an interview, P.S. Like, yeah. It's awful. The engineers don't know what they're doing.
Because
like, obviously you haven't gone in and really understood why.
That's exactly what I'm saying. Yeah. Like interaction design can help you evaluate how the team made decisions. And what you're going to find, I'm pretty confident, is, oh, this makes a lot of sense. I don't agree with it. It can be better. But yeah, this makes a lot of sense. So interaction design can help you develop that empathy for your team, but also understand the current state of the world as it exists. And then also what might... Where are areas for opportunity? Where can you improve? Where should the team be investing that time? It's a worthwhile endeavor.
Sure.
So I want to give a real quick example, another example of interaction design in a very, I think, familiar way to many of us. One of the largest interaction problems any product will deal with is navigation. How does a user understand the parts of the product and how do they navigate between them? Most often we see this as like a tab bar or a side navigation panel. It's usually a series of links that list out like the top parts of the product. As a designer, this is a really great place to start your exploration of interaction flows, I think. What are the top parts of the product? You list them out. Does it make sense how they're grouped, how they're categorized? Where do they link off to? Do those sections make sense? Is there other areas where the categorization should be the same or different? It's a problem that if you haven't done as a designer, you should definitely explore. I think you can do it for like free products you see out in the world. Go ahead.
It's a really good way to understand the system conceptual and mental models too. And I think of, you know, some not great examples tend to be in like healthcare and finance and some of in banking and some of the more antiquated industries, although many companies are hiring designers to really get into this and improve this. But a system model is like, how does this work? So really, where does somebody need to find, you know, this category of things? And if it's like my benefits, you know, where does claims go versus description of benefits? And really, navigation is interesting because they've typically chosen a couple words to describe a really big bucket of things. And that's the conceptual model, those words. It's like, we're describing this to you as, let's say the word is services. And then the question is, how do I as a user interpret services? That's my mental model. And the thing is, like, particularly when we get into enterprise software, or like, I mean, even like Facebook has 1,000 things you can do on Facebook, like 1,000 things you can do, or Twitter. We start, or LinkedIn, like think of these, like there's so many different places where you can do things. There's generally, you know, for the more media types ones, social media, there's feeds. There's profiles. Sometimes profile is under the list of things. Sometimes it's somewhere else. Does profile mean settings? Does it mean preferences? And you look at that sort of nested hierarchy, and the more different kinds of things you can do, the more complex it gets. And so like bucketing up to that top level, how are we bucketing is the system? How are we describing those buckets is the conceptual model? How are people understanding them? So I love that example. And I think if you go and you like critically audit the things that you're working on, as well as looking at some of these other sites and industries, you'd probably get a really good understanding of just that modeling piece of it.
That's right. And what I like to do in these cases, I start usually with a list in a text document. Here's just a list of all the things just written out line by line. And then I take that into a visual medium, trying to see how the pieces actually connect, what's buried under certain kind of links. I'll try to visualize that by seeing visual connections, really creating a map architecture, and then sharing that with my team and discussing whether or not it makes sense. Did I misinterpret something? If I've misinterpreted it, have our users? Does the backend actually support the architecture? All those kind of fun things. So that is interaction design in a nutshell, more or less. We'll leave some links
for the listeners. Probably missed some things, but yeah.
Yeah, we'll leave a few links in the show notes. If you don't know, you can get that in the podcast episode description. But yeah, I think that's it for this week.
Sure.
As always, if you enjoyed what we talked about, if you found it insightful or helpful, or even if you disagree, reach out to us. I'm at Tanner C on Twitter.
I'm at Jazzy 33CA, JAZZY33CA. And if you have things you want to hear us talk about, let us know too. We have a laundry list of things we could talk about, but I have heard some interesting queries come through that we might be able to touch on in the future too.
That's right. And then, of course, again, as always, if you liked this episode, please subscribe, share a link on social media with your friends, your coworkers, whoever you think might be benefiting from what we're saying, and leave a review. We really, really need those reviews. It helps us out a lot.
Yeah.
All right. See you next week.
Peace.